This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Afghan politician and outspoken critic of the expanding warlord corruption and U.S. occupation of her country, Malalai Joya talks about the war being waged against women and democracy in Afghanistan. Also, former political prisoner Alat Jaradat from the occupied West Bank tells us about the ongoing suffering, including widespread torture of Palestinians inside Israeli prisons and detention camps. Plus, remembering one of this country's greatest storytellers, Brother Blue, and military families speak out on Veterans Day. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the unraveling situation in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. Afghan election officials last week canceled a second-round presidential vote after Karzai's main opposition, so-called opposition candidate, Abdullah Abdullah, dropped out of the race, saying that, quote, a transparent election is not possible. Hamid Karzai was then confirmed as the winner of a second term as president. Meanwhile, as violence and extreme corruption spreads inside the country, and as Afghan people and American and British occupation troops continue to die, President Obama and NATO and American Commander General Stanley McChrystal push forth with their plan to send tens of thousands more troops to the front lines of this expanding occupation. For Afghans, especially Afghan women who dare to speak out against the tide of corruption and foreign occupation of their country, dissent can be met with extreme violence and increased repression. Our next guest is here to discuss the importance of speaking truth to power in a time of extraordinary despair. Joining us is Malalai Joya. Joya is an Afghan politician. She was elected in 2005 and then suspended from parliament following her public condemnation of the growing corruption and the rise of warlords. She's been called the bravest woman in Afghanistan. Joya is 31 years old and is the author of A Woman Among Warlords, the extraordinary story of an Afghan who dared to raise her voice. She is in the Bay Area this week for several speaking events. We'll give you more information on those coming up. But first, Malalai Joya, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you. Thanks for your interview.
So let's begin by having you assess the latest political news from your country. Karzai is confirmed for a second term as president after extremely corrupt elections, to say the least. And the White House and the corporate media saying it's a victory. Now let's get on with sending more troops. How can you assess what went on here? And will Karzai be able to, quote, clean up the warlords and the drug trafficking from Afghanistan?
I think this election quite was a non-democratic election because election under the shadow of gang warlordism, drug lordism, awful corruption and occupation forces has no legitimacy at all. As a famous saying, it's not important who's voting, it's important who's counting. That's our problem. All the boxes in the hands of mafia in this non-democratic corrupt system. That's why millions of people did not attend in the election. Even they use this power, people on the street in Afghanistan, that the result of the election will be like the same donkey but with new saddle. And I think this 8 years is enough to know better about Hamid Karzai and this mafia, corrupt, non-democratic system. And Hamid Karzai, he chose two cruel men like Qasim Fahim and Karim Khalili, who accused as war criminal by Human Rights Watch, and he chose them as vice president. Even Human Rights Watch raised the voice and said that Mr. Karzai insult the people of Afghanistan. But I'm saying no, he's betraying more my people. And he invited many times during his campaign a fascist man like Mullah Omar and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who his name is in the blacklist of the UN, to join the government. And other wanted criminal like Mohakek, like Dostum, like Ismail Khan, Sayof, and these other warlords, they did countless deal with him and also did campaign for him. So situation will be more disaster, bloody, especially for the women of my country after this showcase, this tragic drama of so-called free election.
And talk a little bit about the so-called opposition candidate, Abdullah Abdullah. Was he really a change in policy? Was he really going to represent some sort of rising up for the people? What was that about?
You know, Abdullah is he was the main candidate of these warlords who accused as war criminal by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. To know better about them, you can see these websites at least. And they accused, they did civil war in Afghanistan from 1992 to 1996. And alone in Kabul, they killed more than 65,000 innocent civilians. Same like Taliban, they did violences against women rights, human rights. And this Abdullah, this fundamentalist warlord who after 9/11 tragedy, like many other these warlords, by suit and tie and talking about democracy and talking very well English, they come in power. And my people hate him a lot, like these other warlords. And also eight years after 9/11, again he betrayed my people, as he was foreign minister of Hamid Karzai, this mafia system. And most of these candidates was discredited and known faces. So these warlords in Afghanistan, these fundamentalist Nord Alliance, who are photocopy of Taliban, and they come in power after 9/11, they divided to two parts. One part they did campaign for Abdullah, another part they did campaign for Hamid Karzai. Both of them betrayed a lot my people. Both of them have many similarity. Both of them first puppet, and also they called Taliban these terrorists, and also Gulbuddin Hekmatyar as a brother and invited to join the government. And both of them, when this disgusting law that fundamentalists, Shia fundamentalists made in Afghanistan during the election, despite national international condemnation, this law has been passed by Hamid Karzai, and both of them supported this law. And many similarity that I think this 8 years is enough. Again, I'm saying that to know better about them. And if Abdullah Kam or Karzai in power, situation was same, especially disaster for the women of my country. Even women, you know, two women ran for this non-democratic election. One of them called Taliban is my brother. Another one called Taliban is like my father. And most of these women who after 9/11, they come in power. Same like these men. Some of them are educated fundamentalist ladies. Some of them do compromise with these warlords and just because of the position, and they have symbolic role in deceiving people around the world. For example, in Parliament of Afghanistan, you can see more than US Parliament, more than other countries' parliament, there is women in power. While most of them, again, I'm telling you, same like these men, they are not real representative, and they are like peace show.
Again, that's the voice of Malala Joya. She's an Afghan politician elected in 2005 and then suspended shortly after that from parliament following her condemnation of the corruption and the rise of warlords in Afghanistan. Let's take a step back for a moment and talk about who you are and how you got to be the most brave, some may say the most dangerous woman in Afghanistan. You're young, you grew up as a refugee in neighboring countries after the Soviet invasion, then returned to Afghanistan and eventually became a very outspoken politician and champion of women's rights. You've criticized the U.S. occupation and the growing power of the warlords, and most importantly, you've refused to apologize for your outspokenness. Talk about what compelled you to be who you are today.
You know, we are war generation. I belong to a country that this 30 years war in Afghanistan. After 4 days that I birth, Russia occupied Afghanistan, and their puppet, we call them Khalki and Parchami. They come in power. And also then criminal Mujahideen come in power, these fundamentalist warlords. They did civil war in Afghanistan from 1992 to 1996. Then Taliban come, these terrorist people in power. And then after 9/11 tragedy, back these warlords who did civil war in Afghanistan, these criminal Mujahideen with mask of democracy, they come in power. So still you are looking that situation is disaster in our country. We saw nothing in our life, just violences and all of these crimes that are happening, especially against women rights, human rights. And I think even children of Afghanistan, same like children of Palestine, they do politics, and which is so clear now that our country has been occupied under the banner of women rights, human rights, democracy after 9/11. This 30 years of war, these puppet of Russia, these warlords, these Taliban, they committed crimes under the name of socialism, Islam, in democracy against my people, especially women of my country. So we do our responsibility as a war generation, especially as a Democrat woman, because I believe women rights is not a bunch of beautiful flower or freedom or democracy that US government or NATO gift us.
Malalai, you've had to pay the price, unfortunately. When you're in Afghanistan, you have to remain concealed with a posse of armed guards at all times. What threat do you personally pose to the establishment, to the warlords? How can one woman be so dangerous right now?
Yeah, situation for women in Afghanistan is as catastrophic as it was under the domination of Taliban. Today in most of provinces, situation for women is like hell, while even mainstream media do not dare to go to faraway provinces because Karzai's government has no control outside of the Kabul. And my people make ridicule as he is not able to be like mayor of Kabul. There is no justice in Afghanistan. Today, killing of women that much easy for these warlords, like killing a bird. This is fashionable for the media that every crime happening, they say Taliban did. Only few examples of the crime, they give report to the people around the world. While they are not only Taliban, these warlords as well together, they continue to their fascism. For example, that recently 14-year-old Bashira has been raped by 3 men, one of them son of the member of the parliament, Haji Painda. This Haji Painda changed the age of his son by document less than 18 that do not be punished. And today, rape cases, kidnapping of women, attack suicide, domestic violences, all of these crimes are happening, increasing rapidly. And all of these crimes are happening under the name of women rights, human rights. And also that every man stints of woman commits suicide. And the women of my country, even they didn't gain the limited rights that they enjoyed in centuries of 60s and 70s. For example, right now, as I said, that some women in the parliament, they are in power. A lot of women and they who have symbolic role outside of parliament is very important. How is the condition of the woman? Even in big cities, they are wearing burqa. Today, this disgusting burqa gives us life, and which is symbol of oppression, like a shroud for life body, but we are wearing to be safe. And also that I think alone my life story is enough to know about mockery of democracy and mockery of war on terror in Afghanistan. As I was in the parliament, I was elected member of the parliament 2 years before they expelled me from parliament. It was quite a legal act because I was woman. I was telling the truth. I exposed their mask. I never did compromise with them. That's why even they want to eliminate me. When you compare my life with the life of the when I was activist in the period of Taliban on that dark time, some memories you can read in my book. On that time, it was risky, lots of challenges. But today, even with bodyguard in burqa is not safe. Many assassination attempts they did. And also, even inside of parliament, they threatened me to rape. In the last answer of this parliamentarian in complaining commission of the parliament to my defense lawyer was that we expelled her from parliament. It is not enough. We must punish her with gun. And today, inside of National House, they are talking with the language of gun. How about around Afghanistan? In many examples like this today, 5-year-old baby, 14-year-old girls, and 10-year-old girls, they are getting brutally raped. And these small fishes go into the jail for these crimes they commit, but sharks are free. Then tomorrow they are paying money. Then again they are free and continue to their crimes. As today, I think you are looking, situation of women is disaster. In the beginning of parliament, you know, they made amnesty law, which is so ridiculous, criminal forgive themselves. Me and few other inside of parliament, we raised our voice against that. But who listened our voice? One reason that they expelled me from parliament was that your government say we do humanitarian job there in Afghanistan. We build a school there, while in some big cities that there are some school they build, even there the girls do not dare to go to schools. In Kandahar, 15 girls when going to school, they threw acids on their faces, these terrorists. In north provinces of Afghanistan, media give report hundreds of girls become poisoned. And and these girls, when going to school, they are kidnapping and rape them. And many example like this, that situation of women getting disaster. Activist woman, many has been killed. When they get killed, only you, Democrat, justice-loving people of U.S. and around the world, you know their name, like Malala Kakar, like Sitara Achikzai, like Zakia Zaki, like Nadia Anjuman, Shikiba Sanga Amaj. This list can be prolonged. Activist woman has been killed, as my name also was in this list. One reason I'm alive because of the strong support of these poor, suffer, voiceless people of my country, as I'm changing houses now, safe house to safe houses.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go back to occupied Palestine. Today, as home demolitions continue in occupied East Jerusalem, as Palestinian farmers lose thousands of acres of land to illegal settlement colonies and the encroaching apartheid wall, Palestinians are stepping up the fight for freedom, justice, and self-determination under an increasingly suffocating military occupation. Hours ago, Palestinian activists and villagers managed to tear down a section of the apartheid wall in Qalandia in the West Bank, a city which has been completely encircled by the wall for several years. Using a simple pulley system hooked up to a truck, people pulled down some of the 25-foot-high concrete sections of the wall. Last Friday, activists from the nearby village of Na'alin dismantled sections of the wall as part of their weekly nonviolent protests. These two actions were also part of a coordinated effort to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Meanwhile, Palestinians who have resisted the ongoing and illegal occupation in one way or another continue to languish in torturous conditions inside of Israeli prisons and detention camps. Over 11,000 people, including hundreds of children and women, are commonly held without charges and are subjected to horrifying conditions, including beatings and torture. Our next guest is here to speak out against the brutality of Israeli prisons, as he was a former prisoner himself. Alaa Jaradat is the program manager of Adamir, the Palestinian prisoners' rights organization in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. He's in the Bay Area to share his harrowing experiences as a prisoner and his work campaigning against political prosecution and for the rights of political detainees. Alaa is speaking tonight in the San Francisco Mission District. We'll give you more information on that event coming up. But first, Alaa, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora, and good evening to you and to your listeners.
So let's talk about your reaction first off to the recent events in Palestine, including these two actions against the wall this past week, in which people are taking matters literally into their own hands and beginning to tear down this brutal apartheid wall. What's going on in terms of civil resistance and civil society within Palestine resisting as much as they can?
Basically, remembering or trying to, seeing these events or listening about them here while in the United States, while touring the United States, trying to talk about Palestinian political prisoners, I've seen images on CNN talking about commemorating the 20th anniversary of tearing down the wall, and not a single word or mentioning or drawing parallels to what was going on, building a new wall. Maybe in 20 years CNN will wake up and try to show bits and pieces of what's going on today in occupied Palestine. Actually, the civil resistance and non-violent resistance is not new. It's not today's Palestinian civil society's resistance. The 30s, even under the British occupation, experienced a real long experience of civil resistance, including a general strike for 3 years almost. So it's not really new. But it's today's news, listening to them as you are listening and not living, not being back there to experience them firsthand. It's quite thrilling for me to hear these news. And all the stories and issues and concerns, including from land confiscation, the house demolition in Jerusalem, these are all issues linked, always linked to the issue of arrest, detention, and imprisonment. In fact, Palestinians living under the whole military system, military ruling system, experience it as an issue on its own. You don't have to really resist to experience arrest and imprisonment. if you want to think of it in terms of numbers, since 1967 up till today, over 750,000 Palestinians, about 800,000 Palestinians from the occupied territory have experienced imprisonment. If you think of the population, 3.8 million, this forms over 20% of the population. If you think it on a larger scale, like adults and minors, between 30 to 40% of the Palestinian adult population experienced arrest and detention at least once in their lives. Myself, I did experience arrest and detention, my father, my uncle, so you hardly find a household that did not experience the arrest and detention of a member of the family. And the horrifying experience from the moment of arrest, severe beatings and the use of torture, it touches not only the person individually, it touches also the family, the neighbors. Military raids on whole neighborhoods, rounding up people, children from the age of 14, 15, men and women. It's a horrifying experience to go through.
That's the voice of Ala Jaradat. He's the program manager of Ad-Damir, the Palestinian prisoners' rights organization in the West Bank. Ala, let's talk a little bit more about your story. Tell us about where you grew up, the kinds of conditions you live in as a young person in occupied Palestine, and what happened the first time. I'm assuming it wasn't just once that you were in prison, because usually it's over and over again that Palestinians have been put into prison, taken out, put back in from a very early age. Tell us about what the first experience was like and then leading up to today.
I'm here in the United States, so it's my first time in the United States. I'm here to reflect on the experience of Palestinian prisoners in general, and I'm coming with stories, individual stories, and collective stories of more horrifying experiences than that of mine. But just to give an example of what my first face-to-face with the issue of arrest and detention, it was the arrest and detention of my father when I was at the age of six, waking up by soldiers beating us while we are sleeping, and waking me up at after midnight at 1 a.m. to face about 30 soldiers fully armed, masked, and taking my father away. And then I started to realize or question what's going on, because until that moment, personally, I did not experience or understand the issue, what is actually occupation, or did not comprehend it. Maybe we faced soldiers.
You were 6 years old.
Yeah, we faced it. We kind of understood that the situation is not normal, but until then, I did not comprehend it. My father being taken away, and as an older brother having to run around and buy the vegetables for the house, and you know, trying to act as the man in the house, and it was a hell of an experience. And I still remember those images from that time, after school every day waiting my father should come back from work. And so that was my first hand exposure to the issue of arrest and detention. It followed experiencing arrests and imprisonments of older members of the larger family. And I think by the age of 11, 12, I started to become an activist, a civil society, a social activist, a student activist. And of course, this definitely meant I will experience imprisonment and detention. In fact, based on the military orders under which we all live, there is not a political party that is legal under the military orders. There is not a union that is legal. Everything is illegalized, basically giving the chance to arrest and detain anybody, any Palestinian. So all student activities, student unions are illegalized, workers' unions are illegalized as terrorist organizations. being here or bringing the issue to the United States is actually it's one of the thoughts as a human rights organization, at Damir, as a human rights organization, one of the thoughts, it's the biggest ally, one of the biggest allies of the United States or vice versa is Israel. And lots of money is being put to support Israel and to support this illegal military occupation of Palestine. So it's a responsibility here for people in the United States to take action, at least to oppose. We are not talking about people taking action to solve this whole conflict, but to take action in regards of certain people, individuals, when we talk about students being in prison, when we talk about arbitrary detention, detention without charges, without trial, without accusations, people languish in prison months, years in a row, without ever being told why they are in prison, without ever knowing if they are going to be released or not. So this speaking tour that we are engaging in that will take me to other states and cities in the United States, we are addressing one major issue is arbitrary detention, detention without charges, without trial. Neither the detainee or a lawyer, no access to any legal process to detain people.
And the prosecution, the Israeli government, is allowed to submit what they call secret evidence that the defense lawyer and the accused Palestinian don't have any access to. And I think this is a question, the issue of arbitrary detention and charge, you know, trials without charge, imprisonment without charges is something that here in the U.S. we don't know much about. You know, Israel purports itself to be this great democracy, of course, but what goes on underneath the surface is something that's very troubling. Alak, can you talk a little bit more about this arbitrary detention? How common is it when inside the Israeli military court system?
You mentioned the word secret evidence. It's a term that even us, sometimes we use secret evidence. In fact, evidence, we will know that it's an evidence. Once we are exposed to it and we know and we can challenge it, then it's an evidence. As long as it's secret, we cannot say that there is an evidence. When you don't have access to that information that they claim they have, you cannot see it, neither you as a detainee, the person who's concerned about it, or a lawyer or a defense, and nobody has access to it. So how could we name it as an evidence? Okay, you claim that you have certain information against me, and that's why I should be in prison. So you should face me with this so I can challenge it, try to defend myself. As long as it's secret, then it's your word against mine. And we should not forget we are talking about a military system. We're talking about military prosecutors, military judges. And to grasp the idea, think of it like this. The state of Israel assigns a military commander from the army to be the governor of the region there. And this military commander issues a military order or a military law saying this is allowed, this is not allowed. The same military commander is the one who assigns the military prosecutors, the military judges. It's all one division. So the military judge, the military prosecutor are colleagues working for the same military division and report to the military commander. So the person who issues the law is the person who is the supervisor of the prosecutor and the judge. So basically it's one system that there are no safeguards there for any possible fair trial if there is a trial. So imagine when it arrives to the issue of a secret file or a secret information that they have, who's going to challenge it? In fact, we had very particular cases where a military prosecutor was challenging giving an administrative detention order, arbitrary detention order, that based on a secret file, we want to detain this person. So this person stays in detention. when you wanted to review and you're trying to challenge this detention order, by that time, that should have been reviewed by a military judge, the military commander has reassigned the same military prosecutor who issued the order as a military judge. So the same person sat down to review a detention order issued by himself to see, yes, I reviewed the file and I do believe the information in this file is actually justifying keeping this person in prison. There were cases of military judges after reviewing the secret files saying, based on this file, I understand as the judge that this person did not commit anything to threaten the security of the state, and there is no fear that this person individually, personally, is going to threaten the security of the state, but keeping him in detention might help us in the future, so I thus authorize keeping this person in detention. In this procedure of administrative detention, arbitrary detention, you don't know actually when you are going to be released. So based on these military orders, it's issued, I order the detention of this person for a period they can issue it from 1 month to 6 months because the person forms a threat to the security of the region and the people. Nothing is defined exactly what is the security threat, what is the region is not defined, and who are these people that this person forms a threat to. After the end of this period, you don't know if you are going to be released or not. So you can spend 6 months or 3 months in prison on the date that it's supposed to end and you are supposed to be released. You don't know. So you wait. So you might be released, but you might get a renewal. And there is no limitation for how many times they renew this order. So you can, in fact, today there are about 30 people who have been for the last 4 or 5 years. Every 3 or 4 months, their detention order being renewed. And imagine the situation where the detainee waits until the last day, the last hour, not knowing is going to be released or not. Imagine the situation, the family waiting, not knowing if they are going to be released or not. The lawyers, the organizations, nobody knows. So it's the practice of it by itself. It's psychological torture and actually an extreme form of it. There were cases of people who were actually ordered, released after the end of the detention order, brought to the prison gate and handed on the prison gate in the process of releasing them, handed a renewal and sent back. There was people who were sent back, put in military jeeps to be dropped on one of the checkpoints to go home, and after dropping them, rearrested again.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, it is Veterans Day, November 11th, and I guess many people are thinking about a lot of different things. The war in Iraq, the expanding war in Afghanistan, the recent terrible shooting at Fort Hood. And even as we speak, President Obama is thinking, meeting, having discussions about sending, I guess, anywhere between 30 and 80,000 troops to expand the war in Afghanistan. We have been keeping in touch with Military Families Speak Out, and they are a group of families across the country who give comfort to each other and talk about the needs of the veterans and of the soldiers, and also about the stories that you're not hearing in the mainstream. And I am very proud to be joined by Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson, parents of kids who have suffered in these wars. Thank you both for being with us on Flashpoints. Maybe I should ask you, Nancy, how's things in your own family? Do you know where your kids are now? Is everybody safe?
I'll answer the last question first. I think anyone who has been over to either Iraq or Afghanistan and has come home, and for the families, we feel lucky enough to have them come home. None of them are really safe or sound. They've been exposed to things that could put them at risk for decades to come. But we are one of the families that was lucky enough to hold our loved one in our arms again. We have too many members of military families speak out who aren't in that position, and they can only hold their loved ones in their hearts.
Let's just take a quick look at Fort Hood. I know that you were incredibly troubled by it, but as we were talking before we went on air, you weren't surprised. Give us your reaction, please.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I think about when I look at this, and it's obviously a huge tragedy, but, you know, troops have been dying at Fort Hood and at bases all over the country ever since these wars began. The level of suicides and murders that are going on as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder it's a hidden problem. It's not happening in one single event, so it's not hitting the news. You know, it's not a Muslim who's doing it, so it's not hitting the news. But the fact is that this the tragedy that these wars create has been brought home for ever since the wars began. And I think we have to look at the larger problem of what the wars are doing, not just to the troops when they're actually deployed, but the continuing problems that this war is creating for our troops after they come back home.
Nancy?
And I think the way we phrase it is that it is not a surprise to us at all that the bombs of these wars explode at home, and they will continue to do that. And, you know, our hearts go out to all of the families who have suffered as a result of this, but our hearts also go out to all military families and the families in Iraq and Afghanistan. This violence that wars create is not going to get better. It's going to get worse until or unless we can end both of these wars, bring our troops home, and get them the care they need when they get here.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about what's going on in the world of war, expanding wars, and we are talking with Nancy Lesson, Charlie Richardson of Military Family Speak Out. Yesterday, we had a very moving interview, Nancy, with a courageous active duty private at Fort Hood who attempted to deliver an anti-war letter to President Obama as he was doing handshakes. And it was an amazing story. And then we heard his story about killing a six-year-old. And then I asked him about, well, are there other possibilities? Has he met anybody since or else who has been this close? Are they walking around fractured on base? And he said he was just recently at an attempted suicide and that it's happening all the time. Is this what you're hearing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the statistics, although they're not making the front page, are really out there. In October last month, there were, I believe, 16 military suicides in war zones and at home. You know, it's predicted that the deaths from these wars, suicide, will outpace combat deaths. And the rate of suicide of veterans from these wars and active duty troops is higher than, you know, suicide in the general population. And I think that's for the first time in our history. And so we know that multiple deployments is a huge problem, but so too is one deployment. And I think that's what people need to understand. And for military families, we who are lucky enough to receive loved ones home, you know, in our arms and not in flag-draped coffins, many, many, many families have to deal with the after effects of the psychological injuries of this war that can devastate families and devastate service members. And you know, again, the real way to really deal with this now is to prevent it, to stop it from happening, and that's ending the wars. We also really need to increase the kind of care that our troops get. But as long as they keep sending them again and again into the combat zone, we are not solving the problem.
No, we don't. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, where we try and de-escalate whenever possible, particularly when it comes to war. Right now, we take a little bit of a detour from our typical programming to remember Brother Blue. Brother Blue was, until his death last week, the official storyteller of Boston, but that doesn't tell the story. Blue, also known as Dr. Hugh Morgan Hill, was an ordained minister turned street poet and raconteur who spun tales of struggle and hope on street corners and in prisons, inner city, schools, parks, subways, and churches. The great-grandson of a slave owner and his slave, Brother Blue, rose through the white-dominated spheres of military, the ministry, and academia. He shed institutional life to become a roaming town crier, fueled by his faith in the transformative power of sacred service. So writes book artist, author, visual sound poet Warren Lira in the opening of one of his books in his eclectic portrait series that features Brother Blue. Warren is also the co-author with Judith Sloan of Crossing the Boulevard. And as a matter of full disclosure, I have also had the honor to collaborate a little bit on several projects and plays with Warren. He joins us from somewhere in the middle of the great state of Utah. Warren Lira, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you with us. And it was a great loss, I know, for you, for the people of Boston who grew to know and love and look for Brother Blue, that he did, also known as Dr. Hugh Morgan Hill, pass away last week at 88. Tell us how you met him and how that unfolded, why you were interested.
I was teaching at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth, southeastern Massachusetts, and I would go up to Boston, the closest city to where it was at the time, big city, and I saw him in Cambridge telling stories on the street, and I was immediately attracted to his power, the love that emanated from him, the musicality of his storytelling. And I also would hear him tell children's stories on WGBH, on the radio, over the airwaves. And some years later, by which point I'd living in New York, I started working on a series of books of eccentric Americans, people who straddle the wobbly line between brilliance and madness, mostly of people who are not known, but are known locally as stoop philosophers or sit-down comedians. And then I invited Blue to come give a talk, a lecture, where I teach at State University of New York at Purchase. And he took off his shoes and he gave this incredible talk to the students. And I thought, gee, I should really include him as in part of this series. But he was not, he's not unknown. As you mentioned, he is the official storyteller of Boston and Cambridge. And a marketing genius that I am, I thought, well, I can't include him because people know him. But really, he should be a national treasure. And he's not known in the way that he should. And I decided to include him in the series and not reproduce the stories that he tells as a storyteller, for the most part, which are his versions of Shakespeare, King Lear, Hans Christian Andersen, The Ugly Duckling, and his own stories of Miss Wunderlich, the teacher when he was a little kid who helped wake him up to the possibility that he could be worth something, or the story of Muddy Duddy, but his own life stories that he really didn't tell as a storyteller, and that's what my book does. And for 8 years, I hung out with him and his wife, Ruth Hill. He would come and stay at my home in Queens, New York. I would come and visit him and just hang around and tape record him telling stories publicly, but then also across the table in his home or in a cafe in Cambridge. And I just fell in love with this man and was so transformed and honored that he revealed so much of his life to me.
And he officiated in his religious role as he did the wedding for you.
Yes, he did. And, this was not news my parents wanted to hear. Here I was marrying a Jewish woman.
Finally.
Jewish man. And I'm having this ordained priest, a black man, no less, in his bare feet and blue garb with a banner draped across his chest that says Brother Blue Storyteller, who they knew of, and fine, have him to the wedding, but why not have a rabbi? Why him?
All right, well, and just you say between brilliance and madness, and he demonstrated that in so many different ways. But let me just tell people about his educational background.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Harvard University in 1948
mm-hmm.
for, I guess, his bachelor's. Then he got a master's in fine arts and playwriting from Yale School of Drama in 1953. Then he got his doctorate in storytelling from Union Graduate School in a collaboration with Harvard and the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge. So this man is extraordinarily well educated, but he didn't spend most of his time in the classroom, did he?
I also want to add that he was a lieutenant in the segregated United States Army.
He became an officer
during World War II and in Europe and Asia, and was supposed to be teaching his men how to kill, but mostly he taught them how to read and write. So he's, one of the most credentialed people I've ever met, but he really gave his life away on the streets. Some people thought he was homeless. Some people thought he was mad. Not only on the streets, but in prisons. That's what his doctorate was on, teaching poetry and storytelling in prisons. His presentation of his doctoral was with a 25-piece jazz orchestra in a prison.
Wow. All right. Well, let's... And you said he was in the Army. It's an amazing story. We don't have a lot of time to play all the stories, but I will play them over the next couple of weeks. And there's a wonderful story where he's finally become an officer in the Army. And before he takes off for the war, he takes a bus ride and ends up sort of doing a Rosa Parks 20 years before Rosa Parks did it. That's an amazing story. But he was in the Army, but it was somebody who hated guns. And so let's listen to the sort of the story in which I guess he really, really came to loathe guns. Let's listen to the story about the bed. Okay, Warren?
And if I could...
Yes.
If I could just set this up. This
yes.
is from a recording from a Shambhala release where they had him come into the studio and read pieces from the book, which came full cycle from him telling me stories and then into the book and then back to him. And he told this to me on what he thought was his deathbed. He was ill, and he didn't think he was going to make it. And this was a secret story that he never told anyone besides people in his family who lived through it and Ruth, and they thought it was an important story to be in the book.
All right, well, let's listen to Brother Blue. And believe me, this is a story that's going to shake you a little bit in a time when many people are suffering and frightened about being pushed onto the street. This is about poverty and one man's reaction. Listen to this.
I'm just being who I am, doing my thing. And you're picking up on it from where you're coming from, sending it through your own instrument. That's the best kind of jam two people can have. A second chance. My mother told us, you never mention this again. You never bring it up. What happened, happened. From this day on, you never mention it. Not in this house. Not in this family. Not outside. Nowhere ever. You don't utter one word about this. You understand? As far as I'm concerned, it never happened. That's why I never told anybody. Every family has at least one story you can't tell. It's a secret. You're afraid if you tell it, you just might die. You just might get struck down right as you're telling it. We spend most of our lives hiding these things from ourselves and from others. Well, I'm tired of being afraid. I'm tired of hiding. So I talked it over with Ruth. And we decided to tell the story. Maybe it can help someone. Mama, Daddy, please forgive me. I never told a soul about this my whole life. Nobody in the world knows except for Ruth. It's a miracle, really, when I think about it. I'm lucky I didn't lose my father. It was a miracle. I was just a little boy when it happened. And like most little boys, I adored my father. He was kind. He was courageous. He was bigger than life. To me, he was the most powerful man in the universe. He built our house with his bare hands. He was a bricklayer. I used to help him. He was everything to me. It was the middle of the Depression. Mother and Daddy, they did their best. But there was very little to go around. We barely made it from one day to the next. We were the only black family in our part of town on the outskirts of Cleveland, Ohio. We were so poor. When you're as poor as we were, you thank God for Mother Nature. You curse her, too, from time to time. She gave us the woods. As a kid, I thanked God for the woods. Not so much for the timber we used to keep warm that I took for granted. I thanked God for the apples we picked right off the trees. My father would take us to pick apples. Mother would skin the apples and cook them up. They were free. But there's just so many apples you can feed a family. My daddy, he'd walk the streets looking for work. He'd walk downtown, back and forth, up and down, looking for work. He was a skilled craftsman, but he couldn't get any work. His children were hungry. These were desperate times. He'd reached a point where he had to rummage through garbage cans just to bring us some kind of food to eat. He'd find somebody else's garbage on the street and bring it home. Whatever it was, we'd eat it. We'd wear it. We'd sleep on it. We had to survive. I remember one day he came home with that look in his eyes. Seems he'd spotted an old bed somewhere. He tells my mother, he says, "Woman, I know where we can get a bed. I got one picked out. It's a good size. I'm going to have Blue come with me tonight, help me bring it home. We went that night under the cover of darkness. We walked for miles and miles. We walked because we didn't have a car. We didn't have a telephone. Come to think of it, we didn't have a radio. Heaven was somebody loaned you a radio. That was heaven. They're listening to something up there. Even today. Every time I hear the radio, I'm still amazed. You can hear all these things, and it's for free. We must have walked at least 10 miles till we got to a part of town where the rich people lived, in the suburbs. They were rich compared to us anyway. Then, sure enough, by the side of the road, someone had thrown out this beat-up old bed. My father lifted up one end and rested it on my shoulders. Then he went around and lifted up the other end, and then we walked. We walked through the night carrying that bed, the springs sticking out right through the mattress, jabbing into my shoulders and the back of my neck. Between my fingers, I could feel the stuffing coming out of the seam. I was just a little boy. But on my shoulders rested this enormous ancient bed. It was so heavy on top of me, I felt like crying. After a couple of miles, I was so worn out, I just wanted to say, "Stop, Daddy, I have to stop, I can't do it." But I didn't say anything. Because as much as I felt like dropping, I also felt like I was on this incredible adventure. It was like going through the jungle with your father, your warrior father, and hunting down a great lion and bringing it back to the family to eat. Weeping with all that pain that was building in my neck and the weakness in my knees, I remember feeling connected to my father in some deep way, like I never had before. I wasn't his son anymore, his little kid. We were two men out on an expedition. With that journey into the night, I entered the courageous world of this heroic man. We brought our triumph over darkness and danger back home to the family. Back to our little hovel, so my mother and father could take shelter and rest with some greater degree of comfort. We may have been poor. We may have been hungry. But to me, my father was the most omnipotent provider a family could have. About a year later, I must have been 8 or 9. Me and my sister and brothers, my mother, we were sitting around, and all of a sudden we heard this noise. It was like, pow! It was an unbelievable sound that came out of nowhere. It was all of a sudden, pow! Then it was gone. The silence afterwards pierced the air of our small house, till a few minutes later my daddy walked in. Calm. He sat down. He looked at all of us, expressionless. I remember there were some feathers on his shirt. A brief conversation took place, like it was just an ordinary night. Some brief, ordinary conversation on an ordinary night.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.